Hey, everybody, you're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are a progressive politics show broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm with my co-host Ajit, and we have a special guest in the studio, Kyle. And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And for today's show, we are speaking truth to power with the very own Kyle Michaluk of University Underground. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Thank you for being here.
No, anytime. We're always here. Tuesdays, 10 to 11. Okay, so before we talk about UBC's morally bankrupt behavior, highlighted by the RBC branch overlooking everyone in the AMS nest, we are going to have some good news for once, guys. Good news. This is a great way to start the show, guys. I'm excited. Are you guys excited?
Woo!
Yeah, yeah.
So, Indigenous activists win David versus Goliath victory as court rejects $4.5 billion Trans Mountain pipeline. In a major victory for Indigenous groups and environmentalists, Canada's Federal Court of Appeals has rejected the government's approval to triple the capacity of the Kinder Morgan pipeline, Trans Mountain pipeline. On Thursday, Justice Eleanor Dawson nullified licensing for the $7.4 billion project and brought construction to a halt until the National Energy Board and the federal government complete court-ordered fixes. Her ruling cited inadequate consultation with Indigenous people affected by the project and found the National Energy Board's assessment of the expansion was so flawed that the federal cabinet should not have relied on it during the approval process. She said the report failed to address the impact the project could have on the marine environment near a shipping terminal at the end of the expanded line, or the impact of a sevenfold increase in tanker traffic on endangered killer whales in the area. Well, I'm excited. I'm very happy to see that the Kinder Morgan pipeline is no more. I'm sad that we're on the hook for it. That's kind of the unfortunate part of it. But as far as the environment and the killer whales are concerned, we're all very excited. That was courtesy of Democracy Now!, so shouts out to them. They talked about it on the show today, which was exciting. It's nice to see that it's making international news, a big win for environmentalists. Ajit, any thoughts on Indigenous activists beating the Kinder Morgan shareholders and the Canadian government?
Yeah, so I'm going to make an educated guess. I bet it's going to be 95% electoral victory for the Conservatives in Alberta next year. Just a simple guess.
Well, those salty Albertans. Yeah. I mean, Rachel Notley immediately pulled out of the climate action because she didn't get her way. Alberta's kind of stuck because they did not diversify their economy from crude oil, even worse than actual oil, the tar sands, which is far more destructive, far more expensive, and is going to basically signal the death knell of humanity. And I don't know if you've seen it, the aerial photos of the tar sands, but it looks like Mordor.
That's right.
I think Mordor might be a more appealing. Did he actually?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, him and I have great taste. What can I say? It's disgusting, and I'm very happy that it's gone. And all the people that are very upset about it, grow up. The world is we're gonna screw over an entire generation. We're going to screw over our entire species if we keep that up. So, I mean, if you can't say that, like, that this is a wake-up call only because even the justice system can't agree with you, but the planet certainly doesn't agree with you. Kylie, do you have any thoughts on this topic? I know it's not UBC related, but
well, you know, Canada has everything it could ever want. It has all the natural capital and human capital it could do to do any project. I'm just waiting for a grand positive liberty project where we completely revitalize our entire energy infrastructure across Canada. We can do it. Why don't all the workers in the tar sands work for building renewable energy?
Yeah, solar. That'd be nice. Wind. We got lots of wind.
And I bet it wouldn't kill them.
Yeah, I don't think. Oh no! Some birds are going to get chewed up in the turbines, guys. It's really bad for the environment.
Screw that.
It's an eyesore, as opposed to the freaking tar sands. It creates poison pools that, when the birds land in them, they die immediately. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but think about the workers too. They're not feeling good doing what they do.
Not at all.
Oh, of course not. Well, that's why they're on drugs and alcohol. And then I don't know if you guys heard about the man camp controversy with the Indigenous people. This is really disgusting because there's an uptick in sexual assaults, disappearances, murders whenever they bring in the all-male crews to do work in these projects. It's happened in the with the Dakota Access Pipeline. There was a very big murder there, a disappearance of a woman that the police obviously didn't look into, and what was the company that did Dakota Access Pipeline? Energy Transfer Partners. Yeah, Energy Transfer Partners. Although they were paying for their paramilitary police force to disperse protesters, they couldn't pay any detectives to go find this missing woman right next to their project. So it just shows you where they, you know, what they actually give a shit about. Mm-hmm. So before we get too sidetracked, just talking about how disgusting pipelines are and the non-renewable energy sector that is trying to kill off humanity, let's get moving on to University Underground. So this caught my eye while I was in the gym. And I was in the locker room and I was like, ooh, this looks awesome. This reminded me of one of those anarchist zines. It was a non-university sanctioned publication. So I was very excited to look at it. I'm tired of seeing UBC press releases and very, very brutal photo ops. And it seemed extremely authentic and genuine. And honestly, the best part about it for me was the headlines. UBC in existential crisis. Yeah, I can confirm that. I mean, if anyone's ever been here, they know that there's something wrong because there are zero working class people here. Unless they're going into mountains of debt or are working 40 plus hours a week and taking full course loads while on student loans, furthering their own destruction. AMS Royal Bank corruption scandal, we're going to be talking about that. And the administrative takeover of Kerner Library, those are very interesting headlines. And if anyone's been around campus lately, seems to be a lot more administrative buildings, not too much more stuff for students.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird how they always leave us out of it.
Fancy.
Black market degrees, I have some personal stories. stories from that one.
That one's getting a lot of heat.
That one, I will tell you this. That will get you heat only because it affects more people than you think. And it's not even, we'll talk more about that one. UBC's strategic plan is a sham. There's very little strategy and certainly not a plan in there. So the title itself and everything in it is a sham. And the living wage campaign, which I am very excited. I will be a big part of that because, you know, as much as, you know, people can chalk up the rest of the things to conjecture and people's opinions on how things should be run, the fact that people work for this huge institution that pulls in millions of dollars.
Billions.
Sorry. I'm going to have to be a big J journalist here and say I screwed that up. It's actually billions, people. They're taking in billions of dollars and they're going to pay the people who feed, clothe, house, clean up the dorm rooms, do all the things to make this university run. There's not just academics. There's people who behind the scenes that keep everyone's lights on here. And they are paid slave wages, more or less. They are indentured servants. They work to live and live to work. So, and the fact that we have this quote-unquote progressive liberal campus that has people living like that, I find disgusting. So let's get it started. A UBC and existential crisis. Actually, sorry. Kyle, why don't you introduce yourself to everybody and just give them a background of what you've been up to, some of your activism, and what prompted you to write the first issue zero of University Underground?
Well, I first started coming to UBC back in 2004, and I completed an integrated science degree. And now I'm back doing a second degree in mathematics. And so I've seen UBC undergo a rapid transformation from an institution that was designed to meet a research and education mandate for the people of the province to an outright corporation meeting the needs of private greed and international moneyed interests. So the very essence of the academic institution has been subordinated.
It's been hollowed out.
Yeah, and it's a great tragedy because now UBC is just a monoculture of money. And if you don't have any money, you have nothing on campus.
Well, I mean, why bother educating you if you're not already rich? It's not like you can get rich in this capitalist system. It's weird how the capitalists concede they secretly concede things that the left has always been talking about, saying that this is a sham and there's no way for you to really be upwardly mobile in the system of wage labor. And then they just kind of just throw it in your face again because they're like, well, if you can't afford to go to school, there's no point in you going to school because you're never going to make it anyway.
Yeah.
And I find that just like really dispels all the myths.
Equal access to education is such an important issue.
That'd be really important in a meritocracy like we're supposed to be living in, right? Oh, geez. I'll try to stop making more jokes about capitalism.
But the thing is, the money is there. Like, all the money to provide free access education for all the students at UBC exists.
Yeah, you're taking the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, who's going to pay for it? And then you already informed me that we have billions of dollars, so I'm pretty sure we can get a few textbooks and some open source materials for everybody.
Hell yeah.
Oh yeah, we need that. We need UBC open source as well. So UBC in existential crisis, can you tell us, just maybe give us a quick elevator pitch of why UBC is in existential crisis, and what do you mean by that?
Well, UBC has succumbed to agency capture. Agency capture is what happens when an agency has an initial mandate, but that ends up violating its mandate to perpetuate its own power and continuity. So although UBC has a mandate for education and research and higher education, specifically of the people of British Columbia, it's now just exclusively for private interest. The property developers have like unlimited sway on campus. There's 16,000 international students on campus, which is incredible. So what it means is that there's cohorts of highly eligible domestic students that are being denied access to the university in which they rightfully deserve.
And this is important because the way that this university functions is that it takes tax dollars from the province and the province's citizens as they put in those hard hours every single day. And then part of that goes to pay for quote-unquote public education, which has now become private education, more or less.
Well, there's the yearly amount that's given to UBC by the taxpayers, but we have to remember that the entire UBC itself has been built on the backs of the labor and taxation of the people of British Columbia. It is owned by the people of British Columbia for the people, to educate the people of BC specifically. And anyone who thinks otherwise is just insane.
Yeah, they miss the point of what education means to people and what it means to our society, because a common trope is that education is your way out of your low point in society, that if you go to school, you get an education, and you can become a fully functioning member of society. And then so from that, we've basically said that we need everyone to be educated. We need an educated populace, and the more educated people are, the better society is. And now that has gone out the window, and maybe you can start to explain how this agency capture happened and what it means right now, and maybe a little bit in the future. So how did we get here? What's it look like now? And what does it spell for the future, if you can make a prediction?
Well, it kind of all began with the origination of UBC Properties Development Trust. And what it was structured initially as a corporate subsidiary of UBC. And they started leasing out 100-year leases for property developments on campus. And they would use the money to fund the endowment. But what it initiated a self-fulfilling feedback loop of private investment and private greed. So initially, the effects were benign. But now we're at the multi-decadal end point of the process, and basically just UBC's, for all intended purposes, owned by private interests now. It's self-evident. Just look at all the names on the buildings. They're not named after great intellectuals. They're named after mining institutions. Mm-hmm. They're property developers and
judges who sided against Indigenous peoples to get them out of their land. I'm pretty sure Barber was best known for his decisions as a judge.
Well, what's even more controversial is that they're giving out 100-year leases from this land and reaping the profits, but the land isn't even authentically theirs to begin with.
Yeah, and as we announce every 20 minutes here, this is unceded Musqueam territory, people. Let's get through our heads. We're selling stolen property.
So making billions and billions and billions of dollars of profit off stolen property. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely sticking a thumb in the eye of Indigenous people. It's really, and it's flipping the bird to the working class people that have paid for this institution, make it literally run it, because if there's a general strike at UBC, which one day I hope happens, this place would shut down immediately.
But even moreover, agency capture it runs much deeper. It runs all the way into the governance structure of UBC itself. So the people who are most skilled at meeting UBC's mandate are researchers and educators. They are the most intelligent people to meet a research and education mandate. But when we look at the UBC Board of Governors, they're filled with fiduciaries, bankers, CEOs. They have nothing to do with research and education, and everything to do with private profit maximization. So the very leadership of UBC now is bent not on meeting its mandate, but on ubiquitous private profit maximization, which is a real tragedy. Like look at Vantage College, for example. It's a college on campus that has nothing to do with UBC's research and education mandate, but has to do with as a prep school for students who lack English fluency requirements. So they're charging they're making so much money, but that's all it is. It's just a revenue creating business.
And Kyle, I know we've spoken before, and you've outlined in University Underground that this is not a xenophobic or racist argument.
No, sexual orientation, gender, ethnicity, race, these things are
any intersection.
These things are completely irrelevant.
And it's a shame that we have to go there and have to explain away that, because that's obviously the most common charge levied. It's just more of the fact that quite frankly, I don't think it's fair to people who don't speak English to charge them out the wazoo to go to this school. If your mandate is to help educate people and learn how to speak English, why are you charging them these crazy fees to go to Vantage College? Couldn't you just teach them how to speak English in a normal classroom? So it reeks all of just a big money-making enterprise. We got to take a short break for commercials, and we'll be right back. We'll be continuing to talk with Kyle, the author of University Underground, and we'll be discussing more issues with UBC.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke you every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway.
Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm here with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm here with our guest, Kyle, today, and we're talking about University Underground, his great anarchist publication.
Anarchist?
Yeah, man. You don't care. You're just putting it out for the people. You know, we're giving power back to the people.
For the people all the time.
Yeah, all the time, 24/7. And that's how we do it out here. So obviously we had to reach out to you after I saw your fantastic work in the locker room at the Coop. So we just touched on the agency capture that's happened at University of British Columbia. And if you don't mind giving us an elevator pitch just one more time for our listeners, what agency capture is in just a couple sentences.
No, it's just that the fundamental mandate of UBC has been subordinated to the power and continuity of the leadership of UBC itself. So what it means is that the mandate has been subordinated to other interests.
Yeah, we've gone from education to just to making money.
Just to making money.
Yeah, but we're at least, you know what I will say, you know, we're making money, so we're not seeing any of it, but at least they're doing that well. So they're really good at screwing us, and they're really good at raking in the cash. So whenever someone tells you, how are you going to pay for it? Well, look, there's been billions of dollars of stolen land sold off, and the university's got it, okay? So when we talk about the living wage, too, just know that's BS when everyone says we don't have enough money. So the article that I thought was my favorite personally was the AMS Royal Bank corruption scandal. And that one, I feel like Redditors have latched onto quite a bit just because it's very controversial. And on top of that, it was shocking to me because as someone who likes to think of themselves as woke and not broke, I really know what's going on. And I totally missed that because when I walked by the new RBC branch, I'm like, huh, that's odd to have a bank branch inside of a student union building. And of course, you know, as a good little worker, I didn't question anything around me, and I just accepted it. I'm like, oh, RBC's here, better just do business with them then, because they're the closest ones to us. So maybe Kyle, you could shed some light on what's going on with the AMS and RBC.
Well, the Nest building that we're actually recording in right now was initially funded with a UBC loan to the AMS, and then that loan was transferred to RBC. So RBC is the holder of the construction mortgage of the Nest building, which is a multi-million dollar building. So basically, the RBC is in a position of financial dominance over the student government. And it's no surprise, recently, just a brand new RBC bank was put at the very center of the student union building. Now, almost 6 months ago, an inquiry was made to ascertain the precise or the specifications of how long RBC would be in the Nest, and they were unwilling to give the lease agreement, and so it's What do you have is you have a bank that's in a position of financial dominance over the student government, then setting up its own branch in the same building that it holds the construction mortgage for. For me, that's just a clear-cut case of conflict of interest.
Yeah, I think that really fits the bill for conflict of interest.
But more importantly, that there it's right now completely opaque. No one knows how long RBC is going to be here. No one knows exactly what compensation there has been traded. No one knows.
Okay, so the common Reddit assaults against you, which are, you know, we got to trust Reddit comments because those are the top minds of UBC. they populate r/UBC, and they only have the best takes on anything. And, you know, the most common thing is, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. You're just, you're just saying things without any evidence. And although you've explained it to us, so I feel kind of bad asking you that after. I'm not trying to erase the evidence you just put in front of us, which was that RBC does own the mortgage for the AMS Nest building, but can you just maybe respond to the haters out there, the Reddit trolls that just need to take down the people fighting for the people?
Well, you know, in today's era of fake news, often one of the great ad hominem attacks is just to label something a conspiracy theory, the issue is here is that the AMS is accountable to the students. And it needs to be fully transparent in all its operations. And the unwillingness to release that agreement, there must be a sufficient reason. And not disclosing it is outright corruption. For me, intentional obfuscation of information that should be under public purview is just wrong.
I completely agree.
So what might have a more transparent alternative have been, as opposed to maybe another bank obviously taking it over? Could the AMS have just became the personal owner, the holder of the mortgage itself? Or was there some sort of other institution that the loan could have been transferred over to?
Well, the interesting thing is that UBC was the initial holder of the loan to the AMS. So mm-hmm. why would UBC give away the all the interest payments to a private corporation when they could have been the ones receiving the interest payments themselves? So it's about again subordinating public interest to private greed.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that maybe the people that run UBC might also be best buddies with the people who who run RBC and are happy to, you know, give a few percentage payments here and there, so I'll scratch your back, you scratch kind of mine? It sounds like you're alluding to one of these kind of deals going on here.
Well, you're actually cutting to the very core of the problem is UBC Investment Management Trust is actually the managers of the university endowment. But it's structured as a corporate subsidiary of UBC, impenetrable to freedom of information requests. So no one knows how the finances of UBC are really being operated. No one knows, and that's a huge problem, just a rotting cancer at the very core of UBC.
Well, if we can just broaden this topic a bit more, I feel like this route of universities have becoming more corporatized. It's been a route that a lot of public research institutions have been going down, not just UBC, American ones, and tons of,
of course,
other Canadian ones.
Yeah, yeah.
So essentially, aren't we kind of fighting against the tide or whatnot? Is it not more of an impossible thing at this point? I feel that universities have just become a brand at this point.
Well, you know, the big difference between private and public interest is that private is always for private shareholders,
for individuals.
Yeah. Whereas the idea of a public education institute is that it invests in things that are for the public good, independent of private greed.
Mm-hmm.
And we are where we are today because generation after generation did so. Now it's a great tragedy to see that investment in the public good being squandered on private greed.
Oh yeah, it's really upsetting to say the least to see that the futures of generations of Vancouverites and British Columbians in general being traded away for money. So something that should be priceless, which is an education, a treasure that should, you know, should never leave somebody and should be valued far beyond, you know, just making a quarterly profit. We've got that completely backwards now. So I'd like to move on to black market degrees. So you started that one off with a massive disclaimer because it seems that the identity politics wing of the centrist, corporatist establishment that just anyone that criticizes the system somehow is a bigot, and you made it extremely clear that that this is not bigoted, but it seems that it is part of a larger issue, which is that China specifically has a ton of capital. They got a lot of money, and a lot of their citizens have accumulated massive fortunes and are now spending in Vancouver. I mean, you're not the only one to point this out. I was at an event that I will not disclose any more about, and there was a conservative MP there who will, you can figure out who that is. And she said, you know what BC stands for? Bring cash. So this is not a new idea. And it just really frustrates me when people pretend like this is some kind of, you know, some kind of bash against a certain people from a certain place. It's rich people in general, and they just so happen to be there's a lot of rich Chinese people. We're not picking on one. They could be from frickin' Switzerland. I don't care if it was a bunch of rich people showing up and buying up educations and buying up black market degrees. Kyle, do you mind explaining to our listeners what you mean by black market degrees and how rich international students are going about this?
The idea of black market degrees is that there's an entire secondary industry of proxy exam takers, of homework completers, and essay writers for sale, and that there's a significant portion of international students of affluence at UBC tapping that secondary market. So this is not all international students at all. Most international students that come to UBC are meritorious and academically honest to their entire careers, but even a small portion of people tapping this market initiates a self-fulfilling feedback loop. It cuts to the very core of the academic integrity of UBC, but UBC depends upon these students for cash. So UBC is in a fundamental conflict of interest to even address the issue, which is interesting. So the surest way to remedy the situation is actually to have a complete accountability and transparency of all international donations greater than $25,000 to UBC.
Yeah, that way we know that people aren't buying their way in there.
No, but and also to see whether the donors are, whether the progeny of the donors are attending UBC as well. The anecdote is, you know, over the years that I've just the recent years that I've been back at UBC, I've had countless encounters with students that they don't speak English at all. It's actually quite embarrassing. Sometimes professors have even asked students to give answers, and the students cannot communicate in English. And these are English language classes in which the assignments are in English, the textbooks are in English. So the question is how are they even functioning in these classes? And the thing is that they're not doing the work themselves.
And that's a huge disservice to them as people. And like, I'm going to start again. This is the identity politics wing of the establishment that tries to call everyone a racist, mm-hmm. that says that, hey, you know, like there's something fishy. It's like if I went to Shanghai University, and I don't speak a lick of Mandarin or Cantonese, and I'm passing straight A's, people will be like, how is Spencer doing that? You know, oh, well, he's paying someone to do it. Like that argument really annoys me because like I have to waste time discussing it. Second, it's a disservice to these students because they're clearly not getting an education. We're not educating people. They're just throwing money for an experience of being here. And it's just completely counterintuitive to the goals of humanity as a whole, which should be that people are smarter than they were the day before. Instead, it's just this. It seems that this place is becoming just rich kid daycare. And I will add a couple anecdotes.
Rich kid daycare, indeed.
Yeah, rich kid daycare, and you rip around instead of toys, you get a Lamborghini. And my point I wanted to say is that there was a Caucasian student. Yes, Caucasian people do commit acts that are unfavorable to the school, and they went to a very prestigious preparatory school in British Columbia, and their applications were written for them. So this is not just that students from the Chinese international schools or European international schools or the Middle Eastern international schools. It happens everywhere. It's just people of affluence find a way to buy their way into the best places. Yeah. And I would like to say that I really liked how the University Underground flows into how money has taken over everything.
It's just everything. And that's if there's one theme that we're trying to address through this entire first issue is how every aspect of UBC has been subordinated to private profit maximization and wealthy privilege, which is a great tragedy for an institution that's supposed to be geared towards truth and knowledge. Because when truth and knowledge become subordinated to money, truth is to the highest bidder and not truth at all.
Yeah, this is turning into Karl Marx's fetishization of commodities on steroids. Where
we're
that,
there.
Yeah, we're already there, people. If you can name it, we're going to put a price on it, and we're going to sell it to you, sell it to the highest bidder. So,
well, what's next? Are they going to be telling super rich people are going to be telling us that 2 + 2 = 5?
Well, I think they already did. Look, I mean, that's probably not the worst lie. I mean, Iraq that had WMDs is worse, in my opinion, than 2 + 2 = 5.
Yeah.
2 + 2 = 5 is a lot more plausible than that. But so moving on, we have a couple more minutes before we have to go to break. So if you don't mind just giving us a rundown of UBC's strategic plan is a sham. I love the slight rhyme too. So shouts out to you for that. I like that.
Not intended at all. So just recently UBC released their strategic plan for the next century. And they have a bunch of bullet points. And really when you look at this, this is a plan for the next century. And it's really,
that's a long time.
Yeah, really, it's a plan without a plan. And the only purpose of a plan without a plan is to maintain the status quo. And so what
are you saying we're guaranteed a century of this?
No. What it is actually like a highly sophisticated way to like just bamboozle people that UBC is going to be doing anything different from pursuing profit maximization on every front. So what it is, it's a commitment to continue the agency capture of UBC, and yet convince people that they're actually doing something else.
And you wrote there some some ideas, some really great ideas. I loved every single one of them. Could you share with our listeners some ideas that the UBC strategic plan could have instead of just doing a whole lot of nothing and pocketing all this cash that's clearly not going back into research and is clearly not going back into it? Because I swear to God, they haven't hired a new prof in like a decade. But yeah.
Well, textbook inflation is something like in the last few decades, it's like the highest inflation of all different commodity groups. So why don't we just institute a plan where we have open coursewares for every UBC undergraduate program? Let's just start a process right here and now where we just eliminate the need for students to purchase textbooks entirely. Students spend on average between around $400 per person on textbooks per year. You do the math and it's a lot
it's
of money.
Ridiculous, yeah.
What about the legal unification of UBC proper with Investment Management Trust and UBC Properties Development Trust? Right there, but that in that single process, we would have complete transparency and accountability of every dollar at UBC. Now that scares the fucking shit out of UBC leadership.
Oh my God! Wait, what? We can't just shove it in our pockets and just screw over an entire generation, Kyle? Yeah. Why would you say something so horrible?
That's not fair.
That's not fair. My fiduciary duty.
The other thing is let's implement like a double blind donor policy where there's a complete no strings attached with all donations to UBC and they're completely anonymous. So the receivers who actually spend the money don't know where the money came from at all. So if donors want to give to UBC, they can freely, no strings attached. If they're giving with strings attached, fuck off.
But Kyle,
they wouldn't even give it, right?
Yeah, but Kyle, if why would I accrue all this money if I couldn't just boss around people with it? I mean, that's pretty much
but
it.
But then you have private interests dictating how a university operates, which is contrary to the very essence of a university itself.
I think you're talking all kinds of crazy here. You're saying that people should be doing things out of the kindness of their own hearts. That's a terrible idea. You're saying that public institutions should serve the public. That's nuts. And I'm kidding. Those are the best ideas I've heard in a long time. And I don't know why there's not more talk of this on campus. And I appreciate you putting this out into University Underground.
But what about implementing a campus-wide living wage policy where every worker, regardless of their position, mm-hmm. gets a wage that allows them to live within the community in which they contribute. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's thousands of people on UBC working that can't afford to live in their own community, no. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it sounds like
up with that idea?
I think it was the Dutch when they started taking African slaves from Africa to work for them. I think that was the first iteration.
It's slavery by another name.
It is. Like the Southerners made a good case why wage slavery is worse. You know, at least you know, when we had chattel slavery, they looked after the slaves, and here we don't look after them. After they clock out, they're the state's problem, and we can just go use public funds to subsidize their living. So we have to take a short break for commercials, and we'll be back and we'll continue ranting and raving about the university with the writer of University Underground, Kyle Mikuluk. We'll be back in just 1 second, people.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latchew Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
I'm with our guest, Kyle Mikuluk of University Underground, and we're talking about UBC living wage. Earlier in the program, we discussed how the university has been captured by corporate interests. It's been captured by the billionaires of our society. I mean, if you look, there's a lot of billionaires on the Board of Governors, all right? Okay, we're being governed by billionaires. So, I mean, if you want to talk about a microcosm of our world, UBC is it. And just like the rest of the world, the workers that actually keep this place going, that people don't give credit to, they complain about on Reddit, which I thought was the most disgusting thread, or Facebook. I think it was UBC Confessions on Facebook, which was constantly bashing the subway workers. It's like, you know what? You want to have a good attitude? Maybe get paid more than like $11 an hour, all right? Oh, they get paid $14. You're proving my point exactly. Okay, people, like, these people are treated basically like, they are treated like dirt, either by their bosses or the people they have to serve, and they get a paycheck that is not even close to what they're worth as human beings. So can you, Kyle, start us off with the living wage campaign and what it means?
Well, the living wage campaign is not new. In fact, City of Vancouver is a living wage employer. It means that every direct employee of the city and every contract greater than $250,000 at a large living wage employer in the very city in which we live has a mandatory living wage, which is just around $21 per hour. And that's just to meet bare income requirements. Now, the real tragedy is that rather than UBC being a leader, it's being a follower. And so rather than being a beacon for society, there's still entire working cohorts on campus that can't afford to live within the community in which they contribute, which is a structural abomination. So the UBC Living Wage campaign is here to remedy that. We're going to initiate a program over the next 2 years to try to get living wage provision implemented into the university charter. It's really, really aggressive. There's a lot of vested interests that would just rather not. They really want to treat their employees like subhuman people and pay them less than they can live in their own community. The other thing is to instantiate all grad students as employees of the university. Right now, there's this whole population of temporary professors and grad students that are living quite impoverished lives, and yet they're the future of advanced education at this university. Mm-hmm. So again, it's the very essence of the university has been subordinated. The people that are essential to research and education are marginalized instead of being put at the very center of the university.
So you just mentioned that the city of Vancouver implemented a living wage policy. Of course, this came years after campaigning and a lot of judicial activism. And, you know, I think it's important to note that this is not the city of Vancouver itself, but just the city government, which does this. So, again, it's very limited to public employees or whatnot. I feel this whole issue of our academic mandate being subordinated by corporate interest or whatnot, I feel it's been very badly exaggerated at UBC, being a byproduct of being located in one of the most lucrative real estate markets in the world. And do you feel this kickback, this backlash against implementing a living wage on campus? I feel the answer is pretty obvious, but do you think it's partly due to the fact that we're located on the west side of Vancouver, which is, you know, of course, a few weeks back we did a radio broadcast where 50% of the real estate was owned by essentially corporations or very rich families. So, you know what, they don't want that type of stuff in their neighborhood because, you know, you look at these workers, a lot of them are immigrants or a lot of them are, you can tell, you know, they're not assimilated into society the same way many students are or whatnot. So do you feel some of that kickback comes from the fact that just because of this university's physical location being on such lucrative real estate land?
Well, no doubt the geography plays a role, but it's more the social dynamic. When we look at the students of privilege that come to UBC, say the 16,000 international students that attend UBC, say a off the cuff calculation, they spend say between $30,000 to $35,000 per year on tuition.
Mm-hmm.
Then they do housing. It's easy to see how easily each student could come to $50,000 per year. So there's an entire population of 16,000 students at UBC campus that are spending more to attend UBC than a living wage in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these vested interests that have would just have no drive to solve the problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
How many of these students have worked construction labor before? How many of them clean their own toilets?
How many of them worked at Tim Hortons to serve freaking coffee never. And donut first thing in the morning? You know, you need that coffee and donut, but you don't want to pay them to live.
I don't know about you guys, but I've seen so many service workers on campus treated like absolute shit
for sure.
by students.
Shit is an understatement. They're treated like slaves.
Almost to the point of me actually getting to a point of physically defending these workers.
Mm-hmm.
Great practice, comrade.
No, and yet we have to develop the idea that everything an individual does is part of a complex feedback loop with the rest of society.
Yeah.
If you're cleaning toilets, it doesn't matter. You're still playing a necessary role that helps the whole community at some level.
Mm-hmm.
And you deserve to be appreciated as such. Every worker has inherent value, and they deserve to be treated as a fucking human being.
Yeah, you really hit the nail on the head that this is necessary, people.
It doesn't
necessary.
Matter. It doesn't matter where your geography is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're fighting for it here at UBC. But yeah, it just the issue is UBC going to treat its workers like actual human beings,
mm-hmm.
or is it going to treat its workers like subhuman slaves?
Yeah, I think Ajit actually hit a nail on the head with the geography affecting the political climate here because, you know, being on the West Coast, best coast, West Side till I die, we unfortunately have a unfortunate stereotype of being liberals. We're unfortunate of being progressives. And I say it's unfortunate not because being progressive or liberal is bad. Well, being liberal, yeah, it's pretty bad. But being progressive is bad. It's that we get the progressive people in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta, they feel like we're being progressive because we're here. But in reality, we have some very conservative conservative laws on the books. We're a city that was basically created for forestry. We're a city that is home to like mining companies out the wazoo. It's crazy how many subside here. And it's basically a resource town that has turned into a real estate bubble, which then in turn, we're covered with the liberal paintbrush that goes all the way up from California to here. And then now we're on this radio show where we're, you know, G and I are quite left. And we're just asking for a socially democratic ideal of somebody, if they put in 40 hours of work, they shouldn't be homeless. That's as conservative as that can get. Not even Keynesian economics. We're talking just regular Adam Smith, Ricardo things. Yeah, right. You know, we're not even in Karl Marx's world. No. So, I mean, what do you think about UBC getting this reputation of being liberal, being progressive, when we more or less are kept with the lights are kept on and the systems are running here with very poorly treated people?
Well, you know, it's people are allowed to have very heightened debate at marginal issues, but the core issues that affect the broader working people are never touched. Mm-hmm. So people are now allowed to call themselves by whatever pronoun they want. You're allowed to have sex with whoever you want. But when it comes to addressing the core socioeconomic issues that provide power and freedom for your daily life, never.
No. No, then you're a racist. You're somehow a racist for that. I don't know how, but you're a sexist Bernie bro. I don't know what the Canadian equivalent is, but we'll find one to call ourselves.
So there's a lot of there's a lot of obfuscating rhetoric that's used to bamboozle people away from the core issues.
I got a question. I felt I noticed this, and going along with some of the liberal assumptions or prejudices, I feel that there is this pervasive dissemination of elitism among students that the university kind of tries to feed us or whatnot. That, you know, when I came in first year, it was this whole I am UBC campaign. And you know what? I kind of felt like an elitist. felt like, you know, elitist jerk my first year. Like, you know, I am.
Because you are.
I'm one of these rich people. Even though I come from, like, you know, middle income from Surrey, whatever, you know, not even close to what these
that's
Hong
very
Kong
true
students or whatnot.
Ajit, but you hit the nail on the head because we just erased class. Yeah. We've erased class amongst all the students because you're UBC, mm-hmm. I'm UBC, the freaking billionaire heiress is a UBC. So, like, what are we? We're all equals, exactly. Apparently, in this incredibly unequal world. But please go on. I'm sorry.
That's kind of part of their machine of brainwashing or whatnot to students, that they do it at the very beginning levels or whatnot.
Well, social capital of the ownership class is kind of something that's never touched, and they have a vested interest. Look at who they're petitioning for donations to UBC. It's alumni, so they're mm-hmm. creating a self-fulfilling feedback loop where they're trying create a club of affluent students. Yeah. that become affluent entrepreneurs and affluent actors in society, and they can keep that within the club.
it becomes a large boys club. We're including girls now because, you know, that's progress, right? The old boys club now includes girls and gays and everyone else, other kind of intersection except for poor people.
Right.
That's the one intersection we don't deal with in our society.
Exclusivity, right?
Yeah, it's very elitist, and I'm happy you brought that up because I think that's something that we need to keep talking about on this show, is the elitist twist to all this and the total erasure of class, especially considering this school is located in Vancouver, which is home to one of the poorest postal codes in North America. And we just completely let that go because we're liberals, we're progressive, and we're ahead of the curve, even though we are so, so far behind of any other actual progressive country. Canada on its own spends the least on social services in the OECD, less than America, people. We're worse than them. So if you're wondering how progressive are we are somehow less than the freaking United States of America, people. Wake up. Anyways, Kyle, would you like to leave our listeners with any thoughts kind of summing up what University Underground means and what we can expect in the future?
Well, the University of British Columbia is built by the people for the people. That's not going to change. Now, it's been subordinated to private interests and ubiquitous private profit maximization on every front. But we're here to shine light on that. And hopefully within the next few years, we're going to exert enormous leverage and make some fundamental change in the operations of UBC to reinstate its mandate to the people for education and research. That's it.
Keep up the good fight.
Yeah, keep up the good fight. Yo. I really appreciate all that you're doing. And it's something that's completely missing because I went for a walk on Imagine Day. And did you go for a walk on Imagine Day, Ajit?
I was boothing.
You're boothing. Okay, so you ran your own booth. We'll get you to plug that in a second. I came up to a club that I will not name. I'm not big into the picking fights with people, but they I will. But later when we have a little bit more clout, a little bit more followers, then yeah, we'll start picking fights with people. But this club is I asked them, "Are you what you're about?" And they said, "We want to eradicate extreme poverty." I'm like, "That's awesome. I hate extreme poverty. I extremely hate extreme poverty." Then I asked them a follow-up question, you know, because obviously I hate extreme poverty, but, you know, I really think that poverty in general should be eradicated, not just on campus, which we have it here, but in the world. And I asked them, "Are you for eradicating poverty in general?" They said, "No." I'm not going to say that this whole club is based off of one person's response because she got a dirty look from her partner, but boothing there. But I think that's indicative to an elitist attitude. Furthermore, I went on to ask, okay, well, you know, there's a clear, where are all the poorest countries? Africa, South America, Asia. Yeah. Ooh, these places, what do they have a lot of? Resources. I wonder why they're so poor. Oh yeah, because American corporations, Canadian corporations, they are the ones that are pillaging the people there. They're making them build iPhones and Foxconn factories with suicide nets around it, so they can't even kill themselves if they don't want to work there anymore. And Canadian mining corporations, which you know, that Chilean mining disaster. Guess what? That's on our hands. You know, we put these people in these unsafe conditions. So obviously, I asked a question. And we also helped the United States overthrow the Honduran government. So that's fantastic. You know, we're in bed with those people and doing disgusting things, taking away people's sovereignty. And I asked them, "So what are you going to do about imperialism?" And they said, "Well, that's not we're not going to do anything about that." I'm like, "Okay, so it seems that not only do we have an elitist institution, but we're basically breeding people to become so numb mm-hmm. to the problems of the global south, so numb to the contradictions of capitalism, so numb to be empathetic with other human beings. I know we'll never meet anyone from Argentina in a mine, or actually Argentina's doing well. I should pick Chile, a Chilean miner, or we're not going to talk to a Colton miner in Congo. We're never going to speak with them, and we're never going to meet them, and we're never going to hear their life story." Mm-hmm. But it seems that in the school, we've just become completely numb. And I was looking for a communist club around here, maybe an anarchist club, nowhere to be found. So it's sad that not all views are represented, but we, thank goodness, have the very conservative UBC Free Speech Club on campus, so that's great. Ajit, please plug your booth.
Right to Play UBC, come join us. We play, go to a local elementary school, lower income, and we just play sports with them. And yeah, just for the kids.
That's awesome.
No political affiliation needed.
Well, it sounds like you're very liberal playing with kids for free. Who's going to pay for that anyway?
That's true.
Yeah.
Kyle, can't afford real sports. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you get him to play soccer. We'll see him in the World Cup. Kyle, where can people find you? Where can they find University Underground? And how can they get into contact with you if they were moved like I was and wanted to get involved with what you're doing on campus?
Well, just check out www.universityunderground.ca and get in contact.
Yep. Send them an email, people. We need to get all hands on deck for this issue because UBC, I know it's we're surrounded by millionaires and billionaire kids running around here in their freaking Lamborghinis and everyone takes the bus. But if we can start building just a vocal movement of people, just a small nucleus, we can hopefully get at least a living wage for people. That's not even like far left view. That's just what should, that's like, if you work 40 hours a week, you shouldn't be living in squalor for that much money. Anyways, we've run out of time for tonight. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back in the next couple weeks. We'll have a very exciting interview with a local author, so that's exciting. And you can check us out on citr.ca to see episodes where you can listen to the podcast and subscribe for an RSS feed. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
You guys are great.
CITR Radio 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine present
The Victory Square Block Party 2018.
We're back with our annual free all-day party to bring summer to a close. Happening on Sunday, September 2nd from 1 to 9 p.m. in Victory Square Park at the corner of Canby and Hastings. With performances by La Casquivana, Princess Apparently, Sorry Edith, Future Star, Mama Rude Gal, Club Sofa, Yep, and Devours. Plus an ice cream truck on site and a raffle for kick butt local prizes.
You're listening to
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Ice cream man, can I have this? I want this over here, and a toast on by my father, and give me this ice over here, and vanilla cone. Thank you, ice cream man. Thank you, ice cream man.